Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in East Asian Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Ed Pulford, one of the hosts of the channel. On the podcast today, we have Ksenia Chizhova, Assistant Professor of East Asian Studies at Princeton University, and she'll be talking about her new book, Kinship Novels of Early Modern Korea, Between Genealogical Time and the Domestic Everyday, which was published in 2021 by Columbia University Press. The kind of Korean culture that reaches global audiences today is often explosively innovative, from genre-bending music to socially astute novels and film. Much of this recent creative wave rests, however, on a long-standing legacy of arguably more measured and regulated cultural output, including literary works written during Korea's last dynastic period, the Joseon. Ksenia Chizhova's new book explores one particularly intriguing strand of late Joseon literary production, namely lineage novels, or Kanmon Sothol. On one hand, these texts have characteristics which would be unsurprising to anyone with a passing knowledge of this period in Korean history, reflecting as they do the importance of Confucian notions of patriarchy and heredity, which coalesced into a powerful national ideology on the peninsula from late in the 17th century. But Chizhova takes us deeper into both the form and the content of these works, showing how close attention to things like the materiality of manuscripts and calligraphy and the complex expressions of both regulated and unregulated emotion shed light on more textured aspects of Korean high society and culture. From gender relations and the interplay of vernacular versus elite culture to the overlapping temporalities of timeless lineages and daily rhythms of mundane domestic life, we get a powerful sense here of a world rich in nuance and complexity. This ultimately was also a world, both literary and literal, which came crashing down on collision with the historical tides which have swept over Korea over the past century and a half. But the lens this book provides into this overlooked aspect of early modern culture nevertheless offers us plenty to reflect on when considering cultural production in Korea over the longer durée. And so it's with great pleasure that I'll say to Ksenia Chizhova, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much, Ed, for having me here. And thank you for a really beautiful introduction of my book.
Well, it's hopefully only the beginning of a, you know, more generally interesting conversation about it as a whole. But before we jump into the actual content itself, how about I ask you some of your own background and what it was that kind of got you interested in these topics?
Right. So actually, I first encountered lineage novels upon the advice of my advisor in graduate school, Professor Jahyun Kim Habush. And she just said, Ksenia, why don't you have a look at this text? It's very interesting. And the first text I was actually reading was The Pledge at the Banquet of Moon-Gazing Pavilion. It's a scarily long novel in 12 volumes in modern print. And what I saw there was a very unusual woman, Madame So, who was beautiful, smart, and accomplished, and who found herself in a really difficult position of being a second wife to a husband who already had an heir, a son from the previous marriage. And then I was basically seeing how this woman was going through brutal conflicts of feelings, which she was acting out in really violent acts against people around her. And this image of unruly woman was really something I wasn't prepared to expect from the society of Joseon Dynasty Korea, with very rigid ideals of obedient femininity. So actually my work henceforward was really an attempt to understand how can we read these texts, where do these women come from, and why would elite women be allowed and even encouraged to read about heroines like Madame So?
Well, that's great. I think that's quite a familiar sounding experience of a kind of familiarity with a broad topic and a kind of general theme several years into research, perhaps, but suddenly encountering something new and surprising that can lead you off down a new avenue. But what was your sort of trajectory up to then with studying Korean culture and literature and so on? How did you sort of first get into studying Korean topics at all?
That was a truly roundabout way. I actually started my work in Russia, and it didn't finish, but I began with actually historical linguistics and Church Slavonic. After that, I did my BA in English, but then I actually was always interested in East Asia for a reason that I completely forgot. And when my students kept asking me, so why are you doing Korea? I remembered that actually when I was an elementary student in Russia, we had a very adventurous teacher in my third grade literature class. So she gave us tongue poetry in translation in Russian. And from then on, I kind of remember that feeling of strangeness of reading this text in Russian and actually feeling that the aesthetics, even the language, is so radically different from what I was used to. So that was the beginning of my interest in East Asia. And then Korea actually came very arbitrarily. I signed up for Japanese, Chinese, and Korean courses, and I could take Korean first. Korean language. And then kind of after that, it just was, accidental, I would say.
I see. So did that involve some period of study in Korea as well during that kind of, was that during bachelor's study at that time?
So actually, I did a year of language in Korea, Korean language, and then simultaneously, I was also taking classes in literary Chinese. So then it kind of anchored me to the pre-modern period, although I ended up working on the vernacular Korean archive.
Great. Well, yeah, and actually those kind of parallel themes of this established, very kind of high literary, Sinitic or China connected cultural form and the parallel existence of that with this more vernacular output is, emerges a lot in this book, which is a really interesting aspect of it. So the book itself, I think you've already kind of mentioned it sort of emerged and the themes emerged during your doctoral study. So was that a sort of smooth process from then to work on this topic during your PhD and then ultimately produce this book?
No, I wish it was smooth, but as I learned the hard way, academic writing is, at least for me, is rarely a smooth process. So I think one of my biggest struggles at the beginning was really just simply getting through the texts. As I mentioned, The Pledge is the longest novel, and reading those 12 volumes, this is not a translation, this is simply a rendition and typeface of the original Korean, it took me 1 year. I could never have done it without the help of Korean scholars who shared their notes, who shared their thoughts. And then my second challenge came actually when I started reading other novels in manuscript, because other texts were not published by the time I was working with them. So actually learning to read vernacular Korean calligraphy was a project of its own. After that, I had to find a framework to discuss these texts, because again, they are kind of unusual upon the landscape of Anglophone scholarship of pre-modern Korea. So yes, the short answer is no, it was not a smooth process. It was very difficult, but I'm glad it's over.
Right. Well, it's amazing then in that case how smoothly the book reads and how all of this weight of real expertise and scholarship, is carried pretty lightly, I would say, making for a very engaging and readable book overall. But as we get into it, then perhaps I'll ask you some sort of general, questions about the topic itself. And maybe we'll start with, could you say a little bit more about what these lineage novels are? I guess it's a very open question, but what is the actual kind of nature of these works?
Right. What lineage novels are, certainly, as with any genre definition, remains open to debate. But I guess for me, I did try to come up with a few shorthands that would at least allow me to pin down some of the prominent features of these texts. So these texts are basically very long sagas, about the domestic life in Joseon Korea. These texts are extremely long, and I think this is important for a number of reasons, because the length of these texts allow them to discuss the lives of several generations of one lineage. And the length also allows this text to focus upon the kind of minute interactions within the domestic space. So it's simply the length represents the attention span given to domestic everyday and also to the monumental multi-generational time of the lineage. And maybe perhaps if I could put down two more things, actually. So these texts are written in vernacular Korean script. This is very important because this points to the emergence of elite vernacular Korean culture that is focused on female readers. And also, lineage novels really come up with a new aesthetics of depicting personal life, the so-called shift from epic to the biographical, where we are really looking at troubled protagonists. They're not really fitting into the binary view of positive or negative version of subjectivity. We're actually looking at people who are going through very dramatic conflicts and this very drama, the personal drama, dealing with unruly emotions is what constitutes the point of narrative interest for the lineage novels.
So, yeah, I mean, again, the way you tease that out, I think, for these kind of everyday complexities on the background of a broader sweep of long lineage stretching off into, you know, time immemorial is a, you know, really interesting interplay, which we'll get into more. But just one, I guess, point of clarification, when you say then vernacular Korean script, and actually there are some great images in the book itself of manuscripts and kind of very good illustrations there. But is this basically what people usually call Hangul, or the in Korean is referred to as Hangul as opposed to Chinese character script, or is it more complicated than that?
It is a little bit more complicated than that, right? So as we know, Korean script was promulgated in the mid-15th century, and Korean script is a phonetic alphabet, right, that renders basically the sounds of the Korean language. So when we look at the lineage novels, they are transcribed entirely in vernacular Korean script. However, these texts actually include huge chunks of transliterated literary Chinese compounds. So actually, in order to read this text, the reader from Joseon Dynasty Korea would have to be familiar with literary Chinese idioms, expressions, and intertextual allusions. And it's actually interesting when I gave my students some of the lineage novels that are translated into modern Korean, they were like, there are way too many hanja, there are way too many Chinese characters. And so, in fact, this smooth surface of kind of flowing vernacular Korean calligraphy in which these texts are transcribed really belies the complexity of diction of these texts.
I see. So the kind of movement to write these things in a more vernacular form, it didn't lead to the total exclusion of these literary Chinese forms. But was it a quite radical move, nevertheless, to have all of this writing in vernacular Korean script, because on the background of a longer history of greater use of classical Chinese? Was this quite a sort of, I mean, revolution is maybe too much, but was it a big step? And was it in these works only that this kind of move happened, or was this part of a general process of writing more works in vernacular script?
I actually want to say that we see a kind of revolution in these texts. And the question remained contested about how did writing fiction in vernacular Korean emerge? What was the first impulse? What were the first texts that were actually written in vernacular Korean? Would it be shorter fiction, or would it actually be lineage novels? And actually, based on the extant references to lineage novels, the earliest texts are, we believe, started circulating in the late 17th century. So some scholars, including myself, actually believe that the emergence of the lineage novel was quite a radical moment in grounding vernacular literary aesthetics that was actually centered on lineage, on feelings, and on the process of creating subjectivity within the structure of prescriptive kinship.
And so, yeah, this kind of change and this introduction of this more or this greater use of vernacular scripts, it also pushes against, I guess, some maybe stereotypical ideas that people might have of Joseon as this period of at least the latter half of the dynasty being more and more sort of tightly controlled by a Confucian patriarchal order, and actually a sort of, if anything, rowing back of certain freedoms within society that that women might have had in an earlier period. But this is kind of, you know, going against that on one hand, but it's also clear that the sort of society that is described is still one that is fundamentally anchored in this kind of patriarchal Confucian order. So could you say a bit more about the broader social context, you know, that sort of hovers over the everyday activity that these novels depict?
Right. So certainly, when we read lineage novels, even though their protagonists might appear strikingly different from what we're used to expect from the lineage society of Korea, nevertheless, these texts and these aesthetics that they represent really is embedded in the social practice of kinship. What was Korean kinship like? Much has been written about its institutional aspects, right? We have the fleshing out of the patrilineality, the clarification of the male line of descent, where the family property and ritual privileges are passed to the first legitimate son, mm-hmm. right? In order to clarify this line of descent, men would have only one primary wife who gives birth to status eligible issue, and women, in order to create this patrilineal society, would then be moved into the households of their husbands, right? Basically spending their lives within the domestic space of their husbands' families. So this is basically the social milieu that gives rise to the narratives like lineage novels.
Mm. And you suggest even that actually the kind of lineage novels arise in parallel almost with this change in the social norms, you know, around kinship practice, right? At this point in the history of this very, very long Joseon period, which nevertheless obviously had quite sort of internal variation and yeah, perhaps greater conservatism on the social level in its later days. This kind of mapping of a literary change onto a bigger historical change, and indeed also, you know, economic and political shifts, is something that is, you know, carried out in many other geographies too, many other linguistic settings, cultural settings. And you do provide a bit of an outline of comparisons that might be made to both, say, European developments or elsewhere in East Asia. So could you contextualize this a bit more? How do we understand this shift at this point, late 17th century or so, in Korean literary culture in relation to other geographies, in relation to other cultural spaces around the world?
That is such a huge question, so I need to remember what I wrote in my introduction. Right? So first is, how do we understand the fact that the lineage novel is basically coeval with the fleshing out of the Korean patriarchy, roughly spanning the late 17th century and early 20th century? So this is really the groundwork for kind of this question was laid out by my advisor, late Jaehyun Kim Habush, who basically said, how do we understand the realignment of kinship life? There are many ways. And one of them is that it actually prompted the rearrangement of affective patterns. So my advisor, for example, she would talk a lot about the change in women's station, this transition of women's life from their natal families to their in-law families that actually prompted these women to kind of sever their ties with their natal families. And then, in fact, what was expected of a woman in Joseon Korea is that she would owe her allegiance to her parents-in-law rather than her own parents. And that is quite unnatural. This transferability of emotion became problematized in other vernacular Korean texts. And here in the lineage novels, I actually see other affective conflicts that arise at the problematic juncture between blood kinship and actually ritualized patrilineal kinship. And one of the conflicts I actually explore is the difficult relationship between stepmother and stepchildren, right? Korea had a practice of adopting lineage heirs who would not be related to their parents by blood immediately, even though they would usually come from the kin group. This is not your child, How do you deal with that, right? So lineage novels, for example, depict that kind of a conflict. So how I understand lineage novels, it's basically the narrative, the trying to work out the accompanying conflicts of feelings. I try to place lineage novel within a broader horizon of the 17th century, the so-called rise of the novel. My work itself is not really comparative, so I can only gesture towards this horizon, which for me is beautifully articulated by Ning Ma in her work, The Rise of the Novel, East and West. And what she actually beautifully does in her study is she disenchants and historicizes some of the really loaded keywords in the study of the European novel, right? So what she's telling us actually is that we see global rise of silver, global commercialization that goes through particular trade routes. And once you have commercialization of different societies, we see a process of unmooring of some of the rigid social structures, and we can see a concurrent shift towards the narrative of feelings, of subjectivities, of individuality, of personhood, what she terms the shift from epic to the biographical. In Korea, we still need to wait for proper kind of history of commercialization. It's a very loaded kind of area of study that I don't want to speak too much about. But Korean society remained much less commercialized than its neighbors, China and Japan. However, what is interesting in Korean case is that we have the circulation of literature from China that Ning Ma herself connects explicitly to this sort of shift of social life and narrative literary patterns, right? So I kind of connect the lineage novel and its own zooming in to the private feelings to certain influence of Chinese literature, but I place it more squarely within this process of patrilineal lineage making that invited all of this elaboration about the place of a person within the prescriptive kinship system.
Mm, so it's something quite distinct from the emergence of a sort of self or a narrative self within, you know, as you've said, often overexposed or overanalyzed European context. You know, this kind of European novel is often held up as a sort of paradigm, as I guess historically so many European things have been via various imperial logics and processes. But you're really trying to situate this in a you know, very distinctively Korean social context. Is that right?
That is right. But I would like to say that, obviously this overdetermined, deep, introspective European self, it has been kind of the ultimate, depiction of modernity, of selfhood, right? So what I am trying to do, following in the steps of scholars like Ning Ma, is to say that, yes, Korean case is distinct but contiguous. There is nothing profound about deep European self. Part of the global horizontal phenomenon, and it's for other kinds of reasons that this kind of selfhood has been privileged in scholarship.
Mm, great. Well, I think we'll get on shortly to the sort of the nature of that self and what that self is expressing. But one final point, I guess, on the kind of broader field of these works. I mean, you admit that there are limits to how much we can know specifically about this, but how do we how do we imagine these were written by whom and read by whom? I guess that's a general question, but yeah, who were the authors and who were the readers?
Yeah, thank you, Ed, for this question. So there's something interesting about lineage novels, the distinction between their kind of materiality, which is manuscripts, and kind of the novels, so far as we consider the question of authorship. So we don't know a single author of a lineage novel. It's actually common for Joseon Dynasty fiction, especially in vernacular Korean, to not have clearly attributed authors. This has to do with the fact that fiction wasn't really a privileged genre of writing. You couldn't really get literary fame by writing a novel. You would rather write other treatises in literary Chinese that deal with other topics of morality, governance, and other public values. Lineage novels, however, clearly had elevated status within the Joseon Dynasty society. These were texts that were considered to be objects of prestige in the families that were able to have them and produce them, right? So we might wonder why we don't know a single author of lineage novels. So my theory is, and that's I'm drawing inspiration from the work of Queen scholars, that most likely these texts were authored communally within maybe families, right? These are very long texts. And we have actually some of the notes that describe that, you know, several family members would transcribe lineage novels together. So perhaps they could also author them together. But I'm, you know, I'm unable to move beyond that kind of communal hypothesis simply because we just don't have enough other supporting evidence. And in terms of the manuscripts, what's really interesting is that lineage novel manuscripts are not silent at all. They are actually sentimental mementos that often contain margin marks that would praise the calligraphy of kinswomen who took the effort and care to transmit these novels for the future generations of readers within these families.
I see. So the actual content, I mean, being novels, being fictional works, the actual lineages described are themselves fictional, right? So there's no possibility of any detective work looking at the nature of the actual people described. It's all being a novel that you can't say, oh, well, this might have been written by members of this family because there are these characters in it or anything like that.
There's way too much impropriety being described in lineage novels for it to really be connected to a particular family. I mean, there are erotic scenes, there are scenes of disease, of pus breaking out, kind of, it's nasty details that you wouldn't want people to associate with your particular lineage group.
So they might have been written to be as different from the kind of details of the actual lineage that feature as the background may have been scrambled deliberately to make it ambiguous what kind of connection it might have had to real people, or resemblance to real characters is incidental, or whatever they say in history, fictional works and so on. Anyway, that's great. Well, I think that's given us a really good overall picture of the kind of context and you know, some of the content. But I think we'll move on now to the actual sort of main body chapters of the book, which is divided into three separate parts. The first looking at figurations of Choson kinship, the second looking at the affective coordinates of kinship, and then finally a third part entitled Reconfiguration, which looks at the sort of longer term fate of these novels, I guess, and how their reception changed. And indeed, actually, you know, I think the structure of the book is one that's personally very interesting to me as someone interested in time as both subject matter, but also something that needs to be reflected in how you write about things. And I think having a sort of historical chapter at the end, or something that continues to historicize at the end, I think is a, you know, very interesting structural piece. But back to the start anyway. So moving on to chapter one, entitled The Structure of Kinship, Generational Narratives. I thought I'd ask basically about the relationship here between domestic space and time and this higher kind of register or level of the patriarchal order, the patriarchal and patrilineal context. Is this something that kind of hovers separately over the domestic space, which is a more mundane sphere, or is there a sort of more complicated relationship between things that are going on in the narrative of you know, domestic life and the broader sense of a lineage, you know, kind of existing separate from that? Could you say a bit more about that, please?
Right. Thank you. I keep thinking that I need to come up with a better way of answering this question. But what's interesting about lineage novels is that they begin with the narrative of the generations that precede the events, and they end with the narrative of the generations that actually born after the events of the novel reach their logical conclusion. So there is this monumental horizon of static prescriptive time that basically tells us that lineage has been there and it must continue no matter what. So there's this bigger multi-generational temporality that does indeed hover over the horizon of the described events. But this temporality also, in fact, informs the domestic temporality that we're looking at. So the main narrative interest of lineage novels is looking at the process of coming of age. Coming of age means you grow into the prescribed role of kinship that one is assigned basically at birth. You will be a mother, a wife, or a patriarch. And these novels show us that this is a very difficult process, that you're not born a patriarch, you're not born a mother. You need to force yourself sometimes into these roles. So the domestic time is the time of conflict, the time of growing up, and the time of coming to terms with these roles. But we know that, you know, even though the protagonists do seem to possess a certain degree of willful kind of desire to do what they want, we kind of know where they will end up. So the teleological horizon really tells us in advance what is going to happen, but we are invited to witness the difficulties, the struggles of growing into the kinship roles.
Right, right. Almost, yeah, like the existence of free will, but within a framework of kind of preordained, I guess, outside power, a larger order. And the interplay of those is something that you chart in a very interesting way in the first chapter by looking both at actually a slightly separate or related genre of funerary works, as well as the lineage novels themselves. But I'll move perhaps on to chapter two as well, which obviously also zooms in on this kinship, and at least I believe is maybe contains some topics of specific interest to you around calligraphy and the kind of actual material production of some of these works. You've already said a little bit about how, you know, it may be that groups of kin worked on these together, authored them together, or transcribed them together at the very least. But I wonder if we could sort of try to understand a bit more about the use of vernacular Korean script as, you know, as something that is formal, as something that is material about these things, and how that intersects with the kind of gender dynamics that are described in the societies in the actual content of the novel. You've already mentioned that female authorship was likely to have been a sort of trend and something associated with these works. But could you say a bit more about the interplay of male and female authorship, the kinds of literary spheres that creators of works like this and other works inhabited in Joseon, Korea?
Right. So I must say that female authorship, I just want to retrace my steps. I wouldn't argue for all female authorship. When I talked about the kind of the mixed authorship, I would consider probably men and women of one household doing the work together. Right? We know fiction was written by many men. So there's no reason to think that the authorship of lineage novels would be gender exclusive. In terms of the literary worlds that readers and writers of this text would have occupied, I mean, we see that lineage novels they obviously are inspired by late imperial Chinese fiction. They obviously make references to the more normative genres of kinship writing, of which the funerary texts would be kind of the most prominent, right? What are funerary texts? They basically neatly packaged the memory of the person within the kind of prescriptive moralistic pattern of recognizing what is a good way to lead a human life. My mother died. She did everything for the upbringing of her children. She was also very skilled in household administration and in the preparation of the ancestral worship ceremonies, right? And after we have packaged the life into this neat moralistic example, it becomes also a literary object that contributes to the prestige of the given lineage, which is said to produce all of these wonderful and worthwhile individuals. So that's where the lineage novel stands in terms of its kind of literary references. Another kind of significant element of the lineage novel is, of course, the allusion to historical events from China, right? Because actually histories, historical romances, they would have been a worthwhile reading material for the elite Korean women, because they would kind of expand their erudition and let them know about, you know, the kind of the broader historical events of China. That is something that everyone was supposed to know. Right, so this is the literary dimension. And in terms of calligraphy, really the lineage novels were the starting point for my interest in calligraphy that is actually ongoing beyond this first project. I was first I found the manuscripts of the lineage novels quite striking, especially because I didn't know that there was such a thing as vernacular Korean calligraphy. Of course, when we look at East Asia, much has been written about the literary Chinese calligraphy and its place within the lives of the men of letters. This was the art form par excellence, and it was also a form of moral aesthetic cultivation for a person to achieve. What is then vernacular Korean calligraphy? So when I first encountered the manuscripts, and I was actually going around and asking scholars, what is Korean calligraphy? And they said, there is no such thing. And so on the one hand, I have this beautifully, painstakingly transcribed manuscripts. And on the other hand, I know, I'm told that there's no such thing as Korean calligraphy. So how do we actually define it? So then I went into the funerary texts to see in this moralistic register, are there any references to writing? And would, if this reference, how can they help us unpack the meaning of brushwork cultivation for elite women of Joseon Dynasty? And I found an interesting notion there that writing is often placed into the semantic continuum of other forms of corporeal discipline. Like they would say, my mother was good at, you know, sewing, and she wrote in a good hand. They would not call it calligraphy. It would, the usual reference to women's handwriting is her letters looked like stringed pearls. So we don't have this expressive register of this fluent, large brush strokes that we can encounter in later Chinese calligraphy. There's something orderly and something aestheticized. And I actually think that what we are looking at here is the emergence of this elite women's culture in the 17th century. It goes beyond calligraphy, right? For example, many scholars are now working on the so-called cookbooks, the descriptions of cooking that actually incorporate quite a bit of knowledge that extends outside of this particular kitchen, right? So what I see here is actually the emergence of aestheticized women-centered culture that actually has its roots within the prescribed corporeal discipline that women were supposed to cultivate, because what do women do within the normative gender framework of Korea? They perform domestic work that is practical and that gives them a sense of self-worth. So calligraphy actually becomes also a form of bodily discipline that in the end brings cultural capital back to the lineage, because women would, for example, also write letters to the closest social circle. And when these letters arrive and they are written in beautiful handwriting, they would be admired. They would again be considered as tokens of the cultured status of the lineage. So that's my understanding of calligraphy in which the lineage novel manuscripts are transcribed.
And it's fascinating that this process you describe of having a question about the actual physical form of the works you're analyzing and going looking for an answer in the works themselves, right? Actually looking, it's sort of a recursive quality to it, trying to find descriptions of the thing that you're looking at, but within the thing itself. I don't know, there's something quite neat, I think, about that in terms of, you know, what was writing like at this time and therefore what is the document I have in my hand. Maybe the document itself says what writing was. That's great. And I think also you've mentioned there these kind of comparisons with China or connections to China, perhaps more correctly put, with lots of the settings and some of the literary tropes drawn from China. But you also draw, I think, quite an important distinction between what you describe as the vernacularization of certain literary forms that was happening in China and how that contrasts to use of vernacular written Korean. Are you able to sort of tease that out a bit more? Is this just a question in Korea of changing script? Is the language itself still quite high register and formal in contrast to Chinese literature, which was maybe in certain circles undergoing a process of greater linguistic transformation, or is it something else? What is that contrast?
So we earlier talked about the fact that even though lineage novels are transcribed in vernacular Korean script, this isn't pure vernacular Korean script. It's actually full of literary Chinese kind of clusters, allusions, right? So we can't really disentangle at some level vernacular versus literary Chinese writing as it was practiced in Korea. However, I think it's a very important distinction that lineage novels are transcribed in vernacular Korean. So there's a different graphics and therefore different significance and different audience to this kind of writing. So I think this graphic distinctness of vernacular Korean versus literary Chinese, and again, this hypothesis has been made by scholars before me, this basically allowed women who were not supposed to learn based on the normative view of femininity at the time. This allowed these women to actually carve out a space of their own through readership, through manuscript making, in this kind of graphically distinct Korean script, which nevertheless was, of course, influenced by later Chinese writing.
Mm. And I guess part of what you do there is try to, you know, blur the lines, or at least dismantle this posited distinction between, as I think already, a male world of classical Chinese and a female one of these more sort of vernacular pursuits. Actually, it's all sort of tangled up together, both because, as you mentioned, men were likely involved in the authorship of and the reproduction of some of these works, which may have been more associated with women, and vice versa. Female authorship here did not exclude use of considerable erudition in classical Chinese forms. So I think that's a really interesting point when we consider this background of, again, stereotypically understood Joseon society as this very, you know, gender segregated sort of sphere. But onto the second part then of the book, which deals with affect and feeling and the kind of, I guess, this subject maybe a bit more that we alluded to earlier, the narrative person. So could you say something about the sort of place of emotion? You've already mentioned some of the sort of, I guess, potentially scandalous, unruly kind of contents that can make its way into these stories that would make people maybe not want to have them associated with their own families. But what is the place here of both emotion as appropriate and regulated within the formal kinship structure, and these more, spontaneous or harder to regulate emotional sort of outbursts or feelings?
Yeah, I think this is really what makes the lineage novel so interesting. When we compare it to, say, shorter fiction in Joseon Korea, we have very clear-cut figures of villains and heroes. So, for example, the evil stepmother, this is such a cliche kind of from shorter fiction in Joseon Dynasty Korea. But when we look at the lineage novels, the stepmother, even if she is evil, she actually is given chance to reform. Hmm. So it almost seems that unruly feelings become a sort of a glitch. It's a moment in time that has to be overcome. And this moment in time doesn't necessarily signal that the person experiencing these feelings is evil or bad. It means that this person is living through a conflict produced by the demands of kinship obligation. Mm. So this kind of complexity, the process of transformation, and also the fact that lineage novels characters, they talk so much. That is what makes it so interesting to me. So when someone is going through trouble, if someone is doing something evil, they would talk about it profusely. They would explain to others, well, this is what happened. This is what I'm going through, and this is why I want to do what I'm doing. So this kind of interest in the origins, the process of unfolding, and then the kind of cooptations of unruly feelings into ordered pattern of life, this is what is really different about the lineage novel when we place it within the field of Joseon Dynasty literature.
Mm. And you kind of you've already mentioned in describing this sort of interplay between people negotiating their everyday existence and their ultimate, I guess, graduation, if you like, into a prescribed position within the kinship system. But I mean, is it the case that the sort of expansive stability of the overall structure is what allows these kind of more heartfelt vernacular expressions of unruly emotion to exist? You know, is it that there's so much sort of firm stability there that you can express yourself more freely because you know that that kind of backstop is there? Does that make sense?
Yeah, I absolutely think that's a great point, because, you must have some confidence that kinship will continue even while you focus on describing its problematic aspects. So I definitely think that the kind of the creative license in speaking about violence, violent feeling, not non-conforming persons, it really depends on the fact that kinship does become so stable and entrenched in the life of Joseon Dynasty Korea.
Mm. And also that leads me to another question, which I guess actually comes up, I think, potentially a little earlier in the book itself, but maybe is relevant here about who the protagonists and narrators or kind of primary figures in these works actually are. Because you mentioned that it's, for example, it's never the patriarch, it's never the actual sort of lineage head or someone who's too integrated into the system. Who does generally have their feelings expressed in these novels? Is it more women than men? Is it more subordinate members of a clan or lineage than superordinate or powerful members? What's the sort of general picture of who is most exposed, I guess, by some of these narratives?
I think, as you said, it's more subordinate protagonists, but they're not exclusively female or male, right? So the two most prominently problematic figures are the growing up patriarch, before he actually assumes the patriarchal power, and the woman, the wife. So mm-hmm. these are the people actually who seem to be going through kind of lots of conflicting feelings.
Mm. Do you have any examples of those drawn from the kind of works, I should say? And again, this could have been something I mentioned at the start, but you kind of look at six different main works throughout the book. But are there any particular cases of, I don't know, like a patriarch growing up that emerge from a specific work?
So let me take a moment to think about this. I did focus my discussion on women because I felt that women are kind of an underrepresented object in the study of the Joseon Dynasty Korea. But we have, for example, in the same work, The Pledge, that gives us the violent and beautiful Madam So, we actually have her, I believe it's her nephew, who, I mean, basically we have a parallel unfolding of Madam So's trouble and In Gwang's trouble that he causes. And basically on his part, we have just generally kind of this. What's interesting about the growing up patriarchs, they always have really very ebullient and passionate personality. Mm. So in fact, the ability to feel feelings, to be at odds with the prescriptive structure, that is actually almost like a badge of honor. Mm-hmm. You don't want someone who is completely docile. You want someone who actually has all of this mojo in them. So they usually go through, they usually have very difficult relationship with their fathers-in-law, for example. Mm. And that's not a proper attitude for future patriarch to have. So it takes some time, some beating, some wise words of warning from their own fathers for these future patriarchs to settle into more kind of benevolent and balanced role. But again, I find it super interesting that the patriarchs are supposed to be somehow unruly at the beginning.
Yeah. And I think that sort of takes us back to this interplay between the structure and the kind of randomness and I guess helps to explain a bit the question that you said you started with about Madame So and the kind of how are these things allowed to exist within this broader system. I guess as we kind of draw towards a close, we'll move on to the very final part of the book and the final chapter, which is entitled The Novel Without the Lineage. So looking at this kind of, I guess, longer term fate and I guess some of the historical contextualization of this genre of work in a more recent time frame as well. So how does this kind of novel or this form of a novel and its longer term existence, including its place, you know, within Korean literary studies today, shed new light on Joseon society and late Joseon Korean culture, as well as, I guess, contemporary attitudes towards that period in time and you know, the last of the sort of dynastic tire sort of spell of Korean history.
Right, so that seems to be a question about archival history in some way. And I find, lineage novels are fascinating in terms of content, but their archival history is equally strange, I would say. So lineage novels become actually completely forgotten in the early 20th century. Mm. And I actually spent considerable time trying to understand how is this possible, because we're not looking at a group of isolated 3-5 texts that circulated during the Joseon Dynasty. I must emphasize, this is a massive tradition. We have dozens of titles. We have thousands of novels, of volumes, right? So basically, we are looking at a massive vernacular tradition that just disappears. Mm. How is that possible? In my final chapter, I do explain that somehow, you know, in the early 20th century, when Korea becomes ushered into the global modern by being colonized by Japan, right, we have obviously huge social changes and also a very kind of momentous shift in literature. What is it worth? What is worth writing about in the early 20th century? It's nation, it's emotion, it's a kind of a person with interiority who will make a good national subject. This has nothing to do with lineage. No one is originally interested, of course, in this traditional Korean literature, and these genres basically die out together with their elite readers, right? So lineage novel during the Joseon dynasty was a very elite kind of tradition. It wasn't for broad public. Broad public could not even read these texts. And so basically when the social system shifts, very few people are interested in this elite genre. So for much of the early 20th century, lineage novels are completely forgotten. No one knows what they are. And then there is a sudden discovery that makes it into newspaper headlines in the 1960s. A research team is working on the grounds of the Changdeok Palace, and they find boxes of novels. And there are all sorts of interesting apocryphal stories that circulate. And there is a belief that even why are the novels in the boxes? Well, that's because North Korean army during the Korean War, they actually packed these novels in order to take them across the border, right? It becomes this fascinating cultural object that's newly discovered. But no one in the kind of second half of the 20th century, no one can even understand or believe that these super long texts would have been created in Korea and women would have been crucial to their circulation. So it actually takes another 30 years until 1990s, when scholars become fully interested in questions of gender, in questions of cultural studies, that actually significant intellectual energy is even given to these texts. So I find that, this group of texts is kind of symptomatic of the certain cultural amnesia that goes into the nation building projects, cultural nation building projects in South Korea in the post-liberation period.
No, that's great. That this amazing kind of nested relationship between text as text and text as archive, and then the broader sort of socio-political shifts that, as we started out with, both brought the text into existence in some ways, you know, emerging in concert with this shift to a particular patrilineal patriarchal order, and also spelled the end of them once society completely upended and there was no elite anymore, that the elite was a new colonial elite or a subsequent national elite and so on, the kind of disappearance of both a reading public and presumably also, you know, the kind of people who are characters in these novels, right? It no longer reflected any kind of society that anyone would recognize. But then also to zoom out another step and say, well, then what was it that, you know, at least, you know, domestically changed views of these novels and even awareness of these novels? It's a fascinating kind of net onion layered sort of analysis of the life and content of these things. So that's really, really interesting. And thank you so much, Ksenia, for talking to us about them today. Before we let you go, and we've taken up plenty of your time already, maybe I'll ask you what you have moved on to since this project. You already hinted at it, I think, or alluded to moving on a bit. So could you say a bit more about what you're currently working on?
Right. My next project is actually tracing the techno-aesthetic genealogy of the Korean script, specifically focusing on the influence of the so-called palace-style calligraphy upon the emergence of national calligraphy, mass mobilization art in North Korea, or even kind of the modern Korean fonts. And this is, again, an archival question. An archival question about women and women-centered practices that kind of exercise important cultural influence, but that also become forgotten, right? So to give just one example is that, for example, in North Korean mass mobilization art, we have a lot of calligraphy. Mm-hmm. And that calligraphy harks back to the form of writing that was developed in the Korean palace in the 17th century and that actually later on influenced elite women's writing in vernacular Korean script, right? So we have the origin of this calligraphy in Joseon dynasty in women-centered circles. And then this practice continues to influence mass mobilization art and some of the Korean fonts that are later developed. So I'm kind of trying to trace this influence and ask, why do we have this lasting graphic kind of genealogy, but why do we know so little about women as kind of historical protagonists at each point that I'm examining? I'm continuing with calligraphy. It's a big project. It's an ongoing project that takes me way outside of Joseon dynasty. I'm still figuring it out, but it kind of carries on my fascination with vernacular aesthetics.
Fantastic. I can imagine that having all kinds of resonances with, I think, other, maybe only partially or to differing extents, explored themes of the interplay of gender and script in East Asia in general, right? With hiragana and katakana in Japanese, with sort of emergence and ongoing questions over this women's script, nushu in China. I think, you know, that sounds like a really promising and exciting project. So thank you very much. But thanks a lot. Ksenia Chizhova, for talking to us today. It was great having the chance to speak to you.
Thank you so much. I really enjoyed our conversation.
Listeners, thank you too for listening, as ever, to New Books in East Asian Studies. It's a podcast on the New Books Network, and it will be back with you again very soon. Goodbye.